Welcome to these sessions on migrations. My name is John Se-Yong from the Melbourne Institute. I will be chairing these sessions. Sorry, we have a late start due to a long lunch. We'll probably just keep pushing until we get into the tea time. So today we have three distinguished speakers to talk to us about migration issues. Australia is a migrant society, but recently we hear a lot of tensions coming from different quarters. Some people who say Australia has too many people, therefore we should slow down the intake of migrants. But on the other hand, economists have been telling us migrants are a major contributor to economic growth and to one quick solutions to our aging population problem. So today we have three speakers, Professor Peter McDonald from the University of Melbourne, Dr. Barbara Broadway from the Melbourne Institute, and Professor Judith Sloan from the Melbourne Institute and the Australian newspaper. We'll have each speaker will talk for about 15-20 minutes, and then we'll have question time follow that. Okay, so let me first call on Professor Peter McDonald to talk to us.
Thank you. So here we go. I've just thrown this slide up to show you where we don't want to be in population terms. This is Japan, official projections from the Ministry of Health and Labour in Japan. And you see the moving from 5% of the population being age 65 and over to 40%. And that's pretty much in train. That's hardly likely to change. That's where we don't want to be. This is where we will be. And so that's two age structures of Australia in 2011 and in 2061, 50-year difference. Okay, the age, we get a little bit older, but actually we don't get all that much older. And as it says there, the bulge in the Australian population remains in 2061 in the working ages. So our situation looks very, very different to a lot of other countries, and Japan in particular, which is the world champion in this regard, in ageing. So why is it so? Okay, here's this slide is just to explain it to you. The ABS, Australian Bureau of Statistics, does population projections, and they did one in 2003, and they did one in 2013, 10 years apart. What this is showing is the difference between those two projections for the population in 2051. Each of them projected the population forward to 2051. What difference was there between the two projections? And the this one here is the children under 10. Between those two projections, the ABS increased the number of children by 80%, a huge, enormous increase in the number of children in Australia projected forward to 2051. But the old population doesn't change at all. And, of course, you get this change in between. Now, this is due to higher birth rates, of course, than were being projected back in 2003, but it's also due to migration. And here's another chart which I find fairly startling. This is looking at the labour force entry age group, 15 to 24, and it looks at the growth of that age group between 2010 and 2050. And down this end is China, which has the lowest growth of that age group. In fact, that age group falls by more than 40% in number between now and 2050. And then we have a lot of other Asian countries. And down the end here with the highest growth of all is Australia. So that we are... You've heard all about all the bad news about ageing. It's not so bad, Australia in the international perspective. And why is that so? One of the reasons I said it is about more births, but it's also about the migration. So this is a, if you assume different levels of migration, 0 through to 300,000, what happens to the percentage of the population age 65 and over? And you can see that despite what you hear, migration has no effect on age structure because migrants get old, just like everybody else. Wrong. So that migration has quite a big impact. It doesn't stop aging, of course, but it has quite a big impact. And one of the kind of hidden reasons here is not that the migrants themselves are quite young when they come into the country, but because they're young and they're single, when they come in, most of them, they have a lot of babies. It's not that they have a higher birth rate, but just because of their number, they produce a large number of children. So how does immigration affect the future size of the Australian labour force? So with zero, and this is going back to 2012 projection, with zero migration, we would have no increase in the Australian labour force. This is assuming constant labour force participation rates. Okay, that underlies that. No increase, and you see that migration feeds through very directly into producing a larger labour force. Okay, so it's in the end, it's maybe GDP per capita that matters. And what impact does migration have on GDP per capita? And here we're assuming that migrants have the same labour productivity as other Australians and they have the same labour force participation rates. We're just dealing with their numbers. And so all this is showing is the effect of migration on GDP per capita through the reduction of ageing of the population. That's all it's showing. And you see it's quite substantial. And from a lot of the discussion we've been having about slowing of growth rates, etc., we sometimes forget this. This is happening right now. This is the retirement of the baby boom generation. Has a big, big negative impact on GDP per capita. But that negative impact is offset fairly substantially by migration, such that in 2053, GDP per capita is about 12% higher because of the impact of, with 180,000 immigrants per annum, because of the impact of, compared to zero migration, of immigrants on the, simply on the age structure. So is there a desirable range for annual migration? Well, it is subject to diminishing returns. The first migrant who comes in makes the biggest impact. But as you get more and more, the impact lessens, becomes reduced. So we were asked, McDonald and Temple, to do some work for immigration, and is there a kind of sweet level? And this is just simply the impact of immigration on the age structure, and it's the flow through to GDP per capita. And we came up with this number, range, 160 to 220,000 a year gave the best result, looking at marginal impacts of additional immigrants. And the migration program has been set smack in the middle of that range for the past 6 years. Okay, well, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on this graph. What I've done here is to go back to 2011, look at the labour force by age and sex, and then project that forward using Australian mortality rates as to what the population would be 5 years later if there was no migration, for example. And that is the population growth effect by three age groups on employment in Australia. In this case, it's just showing the change in the age, the population here. The employment would have grown quite a lot at older ages because of the baby boom generation moving through. It's a bigger population. But at the young ages, it falls. That's just the population, not participation. It's just the population effect. And that is because population at younger ages, at the present time at least, is somewhat lower. This is the effect of adding in participation. So it was just, first it was just surviving the population. Now you add in the change in participation between 2011 and 2016, and you see the effects of participation change are pretty small. Again, the biggest impact is at the older ages, with a greater participation there. And if you break that down by sex, a great deal of it is women, in fact, older women. But at the young age, again, you get a drop. Finally, is the third factor that you add in, is migration. And that's the impact of migration on employment. And this is migration in that five-year period. It's not migration before that. It's only migrants who came in that five-year period. And so the vast, the biggest effect, something like 80% of the total increase, is due to migration. So when we hear about jobs, well, it's 80% were jobs for migrants who came in that five-year period. Here's a few summary measures. What impact did it have on the gender or sex of the labour force? There would have been almost no change for males without migration, but it grows by 306,000 once you put in the migration, and that's the situation for women. Perhaps more importantly is the age structure effect, age of the labour force. Without migration, the employment under the age of 55 would have fallen by about 140,000. But in fact, it rises by 452,000. So that if, when you add those two together, you get the effect of migration in those ages. So migration has a big, big impact on the young labour force, but almost no impact on the old labour force. And so with an argument that older and younger workers are complementary rather than substitutes, that younger workers are extremely good with technology and older workers like me are great with experience and wisdom, then that's a good result to get that combination. What's the impact on other workers? So the unemployment increased in that period, 4.8 to 5.6, and it is mainly an increase in unemployment rate in that that the numbers also go up in that period, but it's that's not related to the migrants taking the numbers involved are way below the number of migrants who've had jobs in this period, so the argument that migrants take the jobs of Australians. There is competition in some areas, but the big story is not that. The big story is that the unemployment is not affected by migration. And among the migrants who arrived in that period, about 4% were unemployed. And that includes refugees. So you've got refugees, you've got the family stream. Only 4% of them were unemployed. So just to end with a few pieces of literature. The Wage Effects of Immigration and Emigration, paper there. The reverse takes place in Canada and Australia, where immigration strongly helps the wages of the less educated. 3.3%, 4.5% in Australia was the biggest result of any of the countries that they studied. That migration contributed positively to the wages of low-income people. It was a study from somewhat back in the past. The Migration Council of Australia's recent study, economic impact of migration flows through into every aspect of the economy. It has a profound positive impact not just on population growth, but also on labour participation and employment, on wages and incomes, on our national skills base and on net productivity. Sorry. Recent study by Bob Brunig, we find almost no evidence that immigration harms the labour market outcomes of those born in Australia, high-level econometric work on Bob's part, and then looking at it from a regional perspective, the two-step visa process for regional migrants, that is you come in on a temporary basis, two-step, and then you move through to a permanent basis, has allowed substantial and effective regional location encouragement for immigrants over the past decade. So we have great trouble getting workers to go to regional areas, but the two-step migration process, the argument here is the migrant comes into the country on a regional scheme, works in the region for 2 years, and a lot of them do stay there, despite the fact that a lot leave as well. Finally, with the Productivity Commission report recently, Australia's current immigration profile is projected to deliver a demographic dividend to Australia and higher economic output per person. I won't go into that, so thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Our next speaker is Dr. Barbara Broadway from the Melbourne Institute. Barbara.
Between 2000 and 2016, ageing in Australia would have led to a drop in labour force participation rates by about 3.5 percentage points had we maintained the same activity levels at every age that we saw in the beginning of the century. But that didn't happen. Instead, labour force participation went up, and that was primarily driven by increased labour market activity of women, which probably has been mentioned a number of times today, and is not all that surprising. But what might be a little bit more surprising is that it was actually migrant women who contributed the most to that trend, disproportionately. And I think that's a group whose importance is quite easy to overlook because they often come to Australia as family migrants or accompanying spouses, and it's quite easy to think of them as sort of like the plus one on someone else's immigration invite. And I think that really overlooks their potential. I'm not here as an expert in migration. I'm a family economist. My background is primarily in maternal employment. And it's from that background that I'd like to talk a bit about migrant women and mothers today, why I think that there's a lot of potential in that group, and a bit about the challenges they face. And I'd first like to argue why I think that actually the labour market activity of women will be key for us to deal with demographic ageing effectively. So these are projections of labour force to population ratios. I think the main difference to what Peter showed you is that it's on a per capita basis rather than total labour force. This is based on detailed population projections from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, using the Census 2011 data and then making assumptions about future number of births, future number of migrants, and life expectancy to arrive at the number of people of any given age who will be in the country at a certain point in time. And then I use information from the labour force survey to get age and sex-specific labour force participation rates. And combining the two should give us a projection of the labour force. Of course, we can do that with whatever scenario we like. The first one I'd like to show you is the middle-of-the-road scenario, just setting everything to medium, the way the ABS specifies, medium life expectancy, medium number of births, medium migration. And in terms of age-specific labour market behaviour, just assume that whatever we observed in 2012 is going to continue in the future. If the universe ever played out that way, this is what the labour force to population ratio would look like, dropping from 53% at the moment to about 48-49% by the end of the century. It's probably not near as dramatic as in other countries, but it's still a drop, right? And now we can start playing around with these assumptions a little bit. What if we implement policies that would increase migration, add more young people to the labour force, and I just used the high migration scenario from the ABS, and that's what the labour force to population ratio looks then like. A lot better than the middle of the road scenario, particularly in the 2040s, 50s, still on the downward trend, obviously. The alternative, or another thing we could do to make the country younger, is add more children. What happens if we use the high fertility scenario instead of the medium one? It's this. It actually goes down compared to the middle of the road. And the reason for that is simply that after a child is born, they typically don't work for quite a while. And instead, they start about 2 decades, quarter of a lifetime, of investments in education and skill at quite significant expense to their parents and quite significant cost to the taxpayer. So in 2015-16, we spent about $87 billion on childcare subsidies, school funding, higher education funding, et cetera. And I mean, all of this is great. I'm certainly not suggesting that that's not good investments. But still, it's a massive monetary benefit that we don't have to do any of that for migrants because they've already gone through their 2 decades of human capital investment supported by their own parents in their home countries. And I think this gap between the dotted gray line, the fertility scenario, and the solid gray line, the migration scenario, really illustrates that particular benefit of skilled migration to the host country. Now, so much for adding young people. The other thing we might be able to do is change the labor market behavior. There would be two groups that would be worth talking about. One is older workers, but we all got only 20 minutes, so I'm going to focus on the other group, which is currently inactive women. What's a realistic scenario there? By how much could we actually increase female labor force participation? At the G20 summit in Brisbane in 2014, world leaders pledged to close the gap between male and female participation by 25% by 2025. I don't think that's super overly ambitious. That's what that would look like. Actually quite comparable to the high migration scenario in the medium run and even a bit better in the long run. And I really think it's not super ambitious. What if we continue to close that gap by half by 2050, by 75% by 2075? That's what that would look like. And I mean, I'm not saying that we actually have policies to really achieve that. This is more to demonstrate the scope of what we could do with increasing female labor force participation. But I think this 25% scenario actually isn't absurd. And another point I'd like to make, there's also these aren't either-or choices, right? There's no reason why we couldn't have migration and increasing female labor force participation. And actually, I think these two will go together hand in hand very nicely because of what happened in the recent past. So as I said in the beginning, we were expecting labor force participation rates to fall, but they didn't. So here you see labor force participation for men in the year 2000, high in the medium ages, dropping off sharply as they get older, naturally. And this is the same thing for women in 2000, lower than the men, but still the same pattern, and also an additional dip in the childbearing ages. So now we were expecting everyone to move from the left to the right along those curves. And they did do that, and they did drag down the average. But what also happened is that the male labor force participation shifted up a little bit, like this, and the female shifted up a lot, like that. And the total of those two movements, moving from the left to the right and shifting up the curve, the total just happened to be positive, by 1.5 percentage points, in fact. So now we can decompose this total change of 1.5 percentage points into a component that's due to aging and a component that's due to the shifting of the curve. And I'm going to show you that separately for men and women born in Australia and born overseas. So the Australian-born men in that time period, 2000 to 2016, became a bit older, dragging down labor force participation rates by 2.6 percentage points, but they also became more active at every given age, pulling it back up a little bit again. Similarly, for the Australian-born women, they became a bit more older, dragging down the average, and they became a lot more active, pulling it up again. During the same time period, migrant men as a group actually became younger. That pulled the labor force participation rate up. They became more active at every age. That pulled it up again. And then the migrant women became younger as a group, pulling up the labor force participation rate, and they became a lot more active. And now keep in mind that the migrant women make up about a quarter of the labor force as the Australian-born women do, but their contribution there is clearly a lot more than a quarter of the total. And in fact, what migrant women contributed to this increase in the labor force participation rate by becoming younger and by becoming more active summed up to 2.1 percentage points. The total was only 1.5. So if we take migrant women out of the equation, we actually would have seen a drop in labor force participation rates. And that's why I think that migrant women are really important. So, I mean, now that has been the past, do we have reason to assume that this sort of thing could continue into the future? That should depend on who has arrived in the last years, right? Because that are the people who should shape what's going to happen next. So I looked at the characteristics of recent migrant survey 2016 that records information on people who arrived here in the 10 years prior to the survey. And that says at the moment we have about 500,000 female migrants in the country, aged 15 and older. Oh, and by the way, this is all excluding humanitarian migrants. So 500,000 women who are now permanent residents or citizens, so we can expect them to stay and to shape the country in the future. But they arrived no more than 10 years ago. And of those, 56% are what I call relationship migrants. So they either arrived in the family visa stream or as a secondary applicant on someone else's application. If we look only at people who came to Australia as permanent migrants straight away without a detour through one of the temporary streams, that goes up to 77%. So for women who arrive in Australia, it's actually more often than not that they are not here in their own right, but because of some form of family relations. And that means they aren't skills tested. And that could mean that they maybe aren't all that skilled. But that's very wrong. 55% of them have university degrees. The equivalent figure in the Australian population, Australian-born population, is 30%, and that's age standardized. So it has nothing to do with this cohort being younger. Another 15% of them have certificates 3 or 4 or diplomas. So this is a cohort where 70% have really high post-school qualifications. They have good English language skills. Half of them speak it at home. Another third speaks it well or very well, self-reported. Actual language difficulty, as in not speaking it at all or not speaking it well, affects only 1 in 6 of those women. And they are young adults. 3/4 of them are between 25 and 44 years old. So all this should really speak very well for their high labor force participation and for continued and increasing high labor force participation into the future. And how do they really fare if we compare them to their Australian peers, particularly in the same age group? Now, if you talk about women in that age group, you really must talk about children. There's nothing that affects female labor force participation the same way a preschool-aged child does. So I looked at data from the Household Income and Labor Dynamics in Australia survey, the 2011 wave, that particular wave because it had a top-up sample that brought in a large influx of new migrants into the survey, so it's well-suited for that type of question. Now, look only at women aged 25 to 44. Women who were born in Australia versus women who were born overseas and arrived in the 10 years prior to the survey date. So if they don't have a young child at home, that's what their labor force participation rates look like. 86% of the Australian-born women are participating in the labor market, and 81% of the recent migrants are. It's lower for the migrants, it always is, although the gap is closing. But the difference isn't huge, right? Now add a young child between 0 and 4 years to the mix. Drops to just under 60% for the Australian mothers and to 35% for the overseas-born mothers. And that difference is really huge. And I think it's also really important because if we could drag those recent migrant mothers up to the level where their Australian peers already are, I think that would make a real difference to overall female labour force participation in Australia. So this is important. So we should find out where it comes from. Now, to be entirely honest, I have no idea where it comes from, but I'm going to speculate a little bit. I think the first thing that comes to mind is probably cultural differences. Maybe in some countries or in some cultures, it's just less acceptable for a baby to be cared for by someone who's not the mother, right? So I split this group of recent migrant mothers into two groups, the ones from main English-speaking countries and the ones from anywhere else. And if it's culture, we would expect the mothers who have arrived from the US, UK, New Zealand to behave quite similarly to the Australian-born mothers, and the difference to really show up is the migrant mothers from other countries. But it doesn't. The overall level of labor force participation differs by country of background, but this drop when a child comes into play, that really differs with migrant status and not with the country of origin. So I think that really suggests that it's something related to migrant status per se. What could that be? So one thing is maybe if I move from one country to another, I lose some of my employability. A degree might not be recognized, or maybe I lose the network of people that I know that would have helped me find a job, or I just don't know the local labor market all that well. But, of course, people would know that before it happens. But these women choose to migrate anyway, right? So maybe that tells us something about their preferences. Maybe on average they are women who are relatively happy to sacrifice their careers for their husbands for that great opportunity in Australia and then say, okay, well, actually I have a preference for working in the home anyways, and once a child comes along, that plays out, and we see what we see in the data. Could be part of the story. Another part of the story could be extended family network. We know that 1 in 3 mothers buy fewer hours of formal care in the market than they themselves spend in the labor market. And the difference is usually made up by grandmaternal care, something that migrants wouldn't have easy access to usually. And if informal care is not provided by grandmothers, it's typically neighbors or friends. And again, particularly for recent migrants, that would be difficult because they haven't had the time to build those relationships yet. So maybe it's related to informal care. Maybe it's the formal care market. We know there are local shortages in childcare supply, particularly concentrated in inner city urban areas. And we know that's the areas where migrants primarily settled, so maybe they are more often affected by local shortages in childcare supply. And then they don't have grandmas to help them deal with that. If they are more often affected by shortages, they should also on average face higher prices. And that would also mean they would more often reach the maximum cap on childcare subsidies. So the proportional cost that gets reimbursed from the government might on average be lower for migrant families than for others. Or maybe it's a mix of all those things or something else entirely. Like I said, I don't really have the answer to that, but I think it's worth asking the question, and I hope we might see some more research into that in the years to come. So to wrap this up, I think if we think of the skilled migration program and look first at this primary applicant that this migration program actually targets primarily, and look at that person in isolation, then we're really making a mistake. There's this primary applicant that wants to come to Australia, but we've just that person probably comes with a spouse, and that spouse is usually a woman. We've just seen the contribution that migrant women have made to labour force participation in Australia in the recent years. But then that woman has a child, and suddenly labour market activity seems to become a problem. And that might or might not have to do with the lack of extended family around her. So I think the total contribution of that original migration decision really depends on a whole chain of other people that are connected to that. And I think it's really important that we recognise these family networks and the role that they play for the original applicant. If a migrant comes here, they have been shaped by their own families in the past. From an economic viewpoint, we'd be most interested here in their parents' and home country's investments in that migrant's human capital. They will have children in the future, and they will make investments in their kids' human capital that will matter for Australia, and they have families here and now. Their partners, their spouses, that's a group that's young, highly educated, and I think their labour market activity could really play a role and help us deal with demographic ageing.
Thank you, Barbara. The next speaker is Professor Judith Sloan from the Melbourne Institute as well as the Australian.
Thank you very much. Did you have a thing? Sorry? She took my doobie bug. Okay. This is the 11th. Economic and Social Outlook Conference, and I think I've spoken at pretty much all of them, so I've been a case of ageing in place, really. It's been quite a sort of demographic transition. And by the way, Peter, I think Japan's a pretty good place. So that's probably... It's a good place, and there are ways, I think, of addressing demographic challenges. So what I want to do today is actually perhaps go a little bit more micro than the two speakers and ask the question, have we got the settings right? I have to compete with this chap over there, isn't that typical? So let's look at the numbers. The numbers that are generally quoted in the migration space is net overseas migration. So that, of course, takes into account the people that leave as well as the people that come. There is a break in the series because it became much more complicated to measure this once we started to have a lot of temporary migrants. In the past, we had very few temporary migrants, and so the NOM was a very straightforward concept. And I think in about 2007, the ABS introduced what was called the 16-12 rule, which basically means you get in the labour force survey if you have been in Australia for 12 months out of the previous 16. And so they had to create this break in the data series. But I think it's pretty clear that the trend has been upwards. The NOM has increased. It fell back after the GFC and currently runs, I think, about 180. In the past, it was as low as 80 and even lower if we go back far enough. I think this is a really interesting chart. As I was sitting at my computer looking through what the ABS had to tell me about this, and this is the proportion of the population of the Australian population who were born overseas. And it goes back to the end of the 19th century. And we obviously went through a long period of time to the end of the Second World War where we were effectively trying to grow our own. And, of course, the migrants who were there representing overseas-born people were largely from the UK and from Ireland, so they were English-speaking. So what we then saw after the Second World War was the famous populate or perish motto-driving policy. We, of course, had a lot of fleeing citizens from Europe, a lot of Italians, Greeks, but some others too, and, of course, continuing a large number from the UK and from Ireland. It's interesting, and that's why I chose to put that oval around it, that there obviously was some hesitation in terms of the approach to policy, starting in the sort of early 70s up till about 2003, actually, where we effectively did pause the migration program. Not entirely. You know, we still had migrant inflows, but the rate at which the proportion of the population born overseas was increasing slowed down quite considerably. And it was interesting that it was really John Howard who decided to revert to very large migration flows. There was a little hesitation during the GFC, but it didn't last very long. Now, if we ask ourselves where the migrants come from, we've, of course, always had the New Zealanders because they can come in any time they want and increasingly they can go home any time they want, which they've been doing as well. But the big swing factors have been migrants from China and from India. And that, and we've seen a drop-off in the ones from the UK and those related countries. Now, I think this is an important chart because when we think of population growth, and I understand why the demographers are very interested in this, it's obviously important to ask the question, to what extent is migration adding to population growth beyond the natural increase? And if we look at that, we see not completely in a linear fashion, but the natural increase has fallen. We had a sort of slightly unexpected increase in fertility, Peter, as I understand it, but that now seems to have dropped back. And so if you were to figure out what contribution net migration or net immigration is making to population growth, it's a little bit over half is the result of migration. So we're clearly getting much higher rates of population growth than we would were we not to have the immigration program at all. Now, here I think is an issue, and I want to be deliberately contrasting in a sense with what the other two speakers have said, because the theme of this session was, in fact, to look at, I think, probably the question marks that are raised about both the size and the nature of our migration program. And so what this tells us, and notwithstanding all those little regional wrinkles, you know, we have got probably, in my opinion, living in Melbourne and having a daughter who lives in Sydney, we have very rapid increases in population in Victoria and New South Wales, and not so, well, in West Australia was very much mining boom related. And, of course, in our old state, Meredith and Mark, South Australia is just, you know, jogging along down the bottom there. So you can ask, what's that? Oh, no, well, there's... they're an island, aren't they? I hope there are no Tasmanians here. Too small. Star. Statistically insignificant. But I think, you know, this is a very interesting point, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why there is some question marks about the migration program, because 80% of the migrants do go to Sydney and Melbourne. They don't actually just go to Victoria and to New South Wales. They go to Melbourne and Sydney. And then if we look at population growth, And I initially had annual figures and then decided the annual figures jumped around a bit. So I took a longer time frame. So between 2003 and 2015, Australia's population grew by 22%. That's a lot. You know, that's a lot. That's nearly a quarter. Whereas Canada, who you might see as our closest cousin, I guess, only increased by 14%, US by 11%, New Zealand by 12%, although in brackets, there's a very big debate in New Zealand at the moment because its more recent population growth has been very strong, with migration as the major contributor. UK 10%, Ireland 18%, and OECD average 9%. So I think you have to at least ask yourself the question, does Australia really want to have population growth, which is, you know, more than double the OECD average, and are there actually costs attached to that population growth as well as benefits? So that brings me to the question of whether we've got the settings right. So as Peter mentioned, there is this thing called the Annual Migration Program, which sets the number of permanent visas that are issued in any one year, and they have varied considerably over time. So we had 80,000 at the turn of the century, but they're now 190,000, and it's going to be 190,000 for the next 4 years. And these permanent visas account for about 20% of all visas granted. And this is something that has changed. In the past, there was a much more even ratio of skill to family, and there has been a definite trend to increase the proportion of skill visas to family visas. Temporary migration, it was, I think, a very big change. I think the Department of Immigration, the Canberra Department of Immigration, was traditionally quite opposed to temporary migration. But the world changed, and I think, Peter, you're right in saying there's a sort of two-step process. It's a sort of try before you buy. You come in as a temporary migrant, and if you want to, you stay. And, in fact, as I understand it, that a majority of the applicants for permanent visas are actually the temporary migrants. The big groups there are the students. 457 visas, they now call them something different. Don't you hate it? You know, you've just got used to one number. They're called something else. In fact, they've divided them into two. And the working holiday makers. And so those three groups make up 55% of the visas granted. And here's an important point. They are essentially uncapped programs. So if you apply for a visa and you fulfil the requirements, you get a visa. I guess they're probably economically influenced in that sense. So there's some equilibration that can go on. And then that last point about them being a pathway. So let's go back to the permanent ones. And again, there are sort of breakdowns in this. So there's the employer-sponsored, that's the blue bit, and the points-tested, that's the independent bit. So they're the big ones. And here, I think, is point number one in terms of policy, and it was an issue that was properly raised in the recent Productivity Commission report on this topic, a very good report, is that the way they test skills for the employer-sponsored is quite different, or not quite different, but different. They use a different list to the ones for the independent testing. And I think that's extremely difficult to defend, and arguably it is too easy for employers to sponsor migrants because the test is pretty slack, and we can come back to that. So, again, they've changed the name, don't you hate it? So there used to be the skilled occupations list, and now the consolidated skills occupation list, but they're now calling them something different too. So those are the numbers. I don't know what... I mean, Peter, you probably know more than I do. I mean, there are 29,000, this is most recent figures, that come in and under the state and territory and regional sponsored programs, but clearly a lot of them hot-footed out of wherever they come, probably out of South Australia as fast as they can. So here's that point about why have the separate occupational list for sponsored permanent immigrants and for independent skill immigrants. I think that's sort of very strange. And I must admit, and Barbara, you would kind of, I'm sure, have these hesitations. When you see these lists of, you know, shortages and forecasting demands and stuff, you really have a sinking feeling because you know that sort of thing is basically rubbish. And it is also subject to, I think, considerable gaming in terms of what gets on the list and what gets deleted from the list, as a matter of fact. So I really ask the question, are there better ways of doing that? Now, this, I think, probably is slightly at odds with some of the information that the previous two speakers have given you. So there you are, you know, keep you on your toes. We know that the skilled primary applicant does well in the labour market, and that's shown up by the labour force participation. But the skilled secondary applicant, or the secondary applicant who's come in with a skilled migrant, doesn't do so well. And I think there's a real issue about whether we should actually be doing some joint testing, because I think there are some issues about the secondary applicants and your data on the fact that they have low participation rates when they have children kind of probably reinforces that point. But leaving aside the skilled primary applicant, basically what we see is that all those immigrant groups have lower labour force participation rates than the Australian-born. So maybe we can open that up for discussion when I finish, because I think that was not consistent with something you were saying, Peter. Here we go with the age earnings profile. We love those labour economists, can't get enough of it. And again, you see the skill migrant does well over the course of their life. The family really does not do particularly well. The humanitarian, again, does even worse. And the general population is there sort of hugging the skilled ones. So I think the message I get from this is that the visa categories matter a lot. And we've been right to emphasise, place a greater emphasis on skill entry, because it's pretty clear from the data that the skill migrants do a whole lot better than those who enter under different visa categories. And here are unemployment rates. Again, the primary applicant skill, very low rates of unemployment, but all the others are higher than Australian-born unemployment rates. I knew what you were going to say, Peter, so I went and had a look at the Productivity Commission report, and I know it's a really bad slide, so don't read it, because you're not allowed to put too much information on a slide. But the point is this, that I guess you're telling me that I should place a great weight between 25% of the population being aged 65 and over and 30%. Whereas I think that doesn't sound very much. You know, we're going to age anyway because the migrants are ageing. So the way I see that is that I don't think that's very much. And bear in mind that figure is comparing it with zero net overseas migration. Whereas, like, I'm happy to have a lower net overseas migration, and so the gap between those two figures would be smaller. And I bolded that bit, which said the Productivity Commission says that immigration does not offer a panacea. It delays rather than eliminates population ageing. Now, that might be something you want to go for, which I think is what you're saying. Whereas I think it's also a legitimate point to say, delay? Let's get on with it. In terms of the economic impact of immigration, I'm surprised you actually raised the PC conclusion, because I thought the PC conclusion was incredibly weak. Because what it said is that in 2060, it's a very long time away, that per capita GDP will be 7% higher. But by the way, we're not taking into account any of these external effects, which is congestion, housing affordability, environmental effects, loss of social amenity, which I think, you know, if you wanted to start putting numbers to that, are going to seriously eat into your 7% higher per capita GDP. But there are two other interesting points to that study, and that is The economic gains are solely the result of having a higher employment-to-population ratio associated with the fact that the migrants do bring the age down slightly and younger people have higher employment rates, yet tick. But the offsetting bit of that is that the real wages actually fall as a result of the increase in the labour supply. So there's actually an effect that impacts on old workers, and it's partly how the model clears. So where I end up really on this is that I think the interesting thing about immigration is this. I think the interesting aspect is the distributional impact, and that's why I think the politics of immigration can be quite a vexed issue, right? So people might be prepared to be convinced that migration is a good thing for the economy, that it's a good thing to reduce the demographic drag on the economy. But you have to be clear that, one has to suspect that there are both winners and losers in that game. So if we look at Borjas in America, he's looked at it and he concludes that the economic impact is slightly positive, but that immigration in that country, which of course includes a lot of illegal immigration and a lot of unskilled migration, favours employers and high-skilled workers, complementary workers, but is harmful to particularly ill-educated, low-skilled incumbents. Now, if we kind of think of the Australian setting, we have a slightly different impact because we have a skill-based program. And so the workers with complementary skills with the immigrants are probably those with university degrees, for example. So we can still make the same distributional case, it's just its nature is slightly different. And then there's an interesting part in the Productivity Commission report which looks at the youth labour market, because if you think of going back to those temporary categories, you know, the big ones are international students and working holiday makers, right? So the 457s, I don't know, they may displace some workers, but they tend to have more skills. And I think you can make out a reasonable case that the incumbent young workers are missing out because of the influx of those temporary workers, temporary migrants, in those categories. So I think when you think about government policy, it's important that I think people want it to be directed to maximising the well-being of incumbents. The incumbents obviously include recently arrived permanent migrants. It possibly doesn't include temporary migrants. And therefore, they should be concerned about the distributional effects. And I think that is where the interesting research is going to be because, you know, for all, you know, the carry-on about those general equilibrium models, it's sort of extremely assumption-driven, whereas I think there's lots of data around that you can have around, including HILDA, but also even the ABS, where we can think about the distributional impact of immigration. So thanks very much for having me yet again.
Thank you, Judy. Now, if I may summarise what I heard so far, it seems like Peter and Barbara are mostly positive about the contribution of migrants in terms of our long-term demographic trends, labour force participation, employment and so on. Judy offers a different take on this. She mentions losers. So I'm going to invite Peter and Barbara perhaps to respond to what the questions Judy has raised. Peter, you want...
The data that I produced show you the long-term effects, but on age structure. But there are quite considerable effects in the short term too through age structure because of the retirement of the baby boom generation. But long way out 2060, that is a long way away. And I think Australia's migration program should actually be responsive to labour demand and relatively short-term labour demand, not looking at what's going to happen in 2060. And so that's why I showed the data for that five-year period, 2011 to 2016, to show that employment without migration in Australia would hardly have grown at all. The people were simply not there, and the participation rates were not there. Would hardly have grown at all. And in
I don't know that counterfactual, by the way. That's an assumption of yours.
No, that's what happened.
You can't answer the question. What would have happened had we not had the immigrants? We might have had people, for example, staying on longer in the labour force.
There would have been some impact. But it would not nearly... The people who are outside the labour force... In Australia, we've had a long, very, very long period where about 12-13% of prime-age workers, males, are not in the... They're either unemployed or not in the labour force. Hasn't changed at all over... And despite all of the efforts we've put into that, a huge amount of money into training programs and so on, number remains unchanged. And one of the arguments that I make is that to say that those people are in that situation because of migration, that if migration had gone away, they would have got jobs, is quite false, because they are in that situation because of their skill levels. And the structure of the labour force has moved way away from them. They are people who, in a past generation... would have got jobs, low-skill jobs, because there were low-skill jobs there in factories, labouring, etc. Those jobs have disappeared. Back in those days, the migrants also were low-skilled. So there was a genuine competition. And so whenever we had a recession, the government reduced the intake. That was the right thing to do. But now we've got a quite different situation. Those people are good Australians who we are kind of leaving behind, and we do them a considerable disservice by saying they don't have a job because of migration, because it's not about that at all. It's about their skill levels and the fact that we have let them stay in that situation forever, and that group is going to continue in Australia. We need to deal with that very directly and not say that it's due to migration.
Barbara, you have anything you want to respond?
Yeah, I think the question you directed at me was mostly about the activity level of skill and secondary, family migrants and secondary applicants. So I think it's right that their level is lower than the Australian foreign population. The point I was making is that it's been increasing a lot more. So just this change over time, and that's mostly because the number you had from the Productivity Commission is about all of them, and I looked only at the ones who arrived in the last 10 years because they are the ones who should matter for what's happening next. Right? So I think that's where this difference came from.
I might just add a couple of things. That you said about the young people and the working holiday makers and students. Students and working holiday makers do work in lower skill jobs, way below their human capital level. In fact, they're excellent workers for those people because their productivity level is way above the jobs that they're actually doing. But we have a social security system. If you look at all the students and working holiday makers, they're working shift work, they're working part-time. The way the Australian Social Security system is set up, it's very difficult for Australians to do that. Because if they get into a short-term job, they've got to go to Centrelink, they're backwards and forwards into Centrelink, they lose their benefits for periods. It's a very, very difficult situation to get yourself into. What they need is long-term, full-time work. But that's not what the students and working holiday makers are doing. So, again, it's a structural change in the nature of the labour force that produces this result.
Well, that's a bad way to defend migration, because basically...
Well, I'm not defending migration in that case. What I'm saying is we should have a social security policy which allows these people to work.
Let's invite questions from the floor. Anybody want to raise any questions? One at the side there. In the back.
Thank you for those speeches. I was just going to address it to Peter. I was interested in the presentation. It seemed to be incredibly positive to the extent that it seemed to be a no-brainer almost. Why would you ever not have a migration? And it seems to be incredibly blinkered in many respects, just some of the negative effects. And I suppose environment being one, what is Australia's goal for a population? How many people can the country support from an environmental perspective? And also, we've got an incredibly lucky endowment of resources from mining and agriculture. Surely the more people we have, the more that's shared. And Australia, we like to think we're an educated nation and incredibly productive, but a lot of what our wealth is based on is that mining and agriculture. So how do you respond to that in the sense that we are sharing amongst more and more people an increasingly sparse amount of resources? And what about the environment? Is the sense that you bring in migrants and they grow old, and then you begin to bring more migrants in? Can 200 million people, is that supportable?
No, I haven't said anything about 200 million people. I haven't got anywhere near 200 million people. And
you've gone towards 50 million,
right? I've gone towards the scenario put up is the 36 million scenario that got Kevin Rudd into trouble. 36 million, long way from 200 million. So don't exaggerate what I'm saying. Yeah? Okay?
No, that is an important point.
Yeah, no, the point's important, but let me answer the point, but not with 200 million, okay?
No, but they don't even want 4
million. Population growth has there are externalities that affect, you know, there's congestion, there's impacts on environment, everything that you said, absolutely true. But if you look at Australian history, infrastructure has always been way behind population growth. It's nothing new. And so it does imply that there needs to be investment in infrastructure. There's also the problem of, well, what do you do about it? So let's take the city of Melbourne. That very big growth in recent times. Pressure on resources, everything else. So people who move to Melbourne come from regional Victoria. How are you going to stop that? People come to Melbourne in net terms from every state and territory in Australia, every other state and territory in Australia in the last year. How do you stop that? Births. Are you going to, you know, put some limitation on births? So that brings you down just to international migration. A lot of international migration is partners in the family stream. The law says that should be that partners have an access to Australia. It's in the Migration Act. But despite that, we're actually holding them back. We've got 200,000, or no, not 200,000, 100,000 in the pipeline at the moment waiting to come into Australia who are partners of Australian citizens. So that's the family stream. Are you going to stop refugees coming in? Okay, so there's one category left, skilled migration. That's the one category where you have some capacity to change things. Are you really going to, in the current labour force situation in Australia, restrict skilled migration but bring in everybody else?
I think you are, because this is the issue. I mean, how skilled are they in reality? Because we know, you know, for example, the work that Bob Birrell has done, which he asked the question, what happens to the overseas student graduates compared with the local graduates in the same fields of study? And the reality is that the local graduates do a whole lot better. Now, you might say, well, that's, of course, just an illustration of rampant discrimination in the labour force. But that is what it is. So, you know, I think it's worth having the discussion, Peter. I mean, you're right. There are a lot of taps they can't turn off. But here is one tap, and they don't have to turn it off. They only have to weaken the flow of the water. So I think it's worth having the debate.
Can you get the mic, please?
Sorry, Can I ask my question? No?
The chairman's in charge.
So where's the mic?
I just want to add, actually, that the government has already changed the skilled migration, given that it was only in April when they actually announced that the 457 visa was going to be abolished. And I hear that you say they have changed the name, but yep. It's not true, because I'm a 457 migrant myself, so I exactly know what impact that has for us as well. So... in a way.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, it's true. Already. There are now two different visa categories that have replaced the 457 visa. One is for 4 years with the potential to move to permanent, and the other one is a much shorter one, 2 years, and they've got different lists for the, another set
and,
of lists.
And in the first 2 months of setting those lists, the government has moved 36 occupations from the low-level one to the high one because they got it wrong.
I mean, it's interesting to look at... they are, because, you see, the government commissioned the Productivity Commission most recently to look at whether they should basically auction visas, right? Because you think, as an economist, you know, you've got excess demand for visas, what would you do? You'd use the price mechanism. And for various reasons, the Productivity Commission rejected that proposal. But it is interesting that the government is quite keen on the price mechanism. So one of the things they've done in the most recent round of changes, and it's partly because they're very short of dough, is that they've really increased the price attached to applying for these visa categories. And, I mean, you know, if you believe in the downward sloping demand curve, presumably you may get some fall off in demand for entry under some of these visa categories. Some of them are quite substantial, the prices.
That's true.
We should go back to that woman. You asked, but...
Hazel.
I'm bossy. Everyone knows that. I know, but she had the...
Can you finish your questions, and then we will go next to the lady...
At the back.
Dr. Moyer.
I had an economic question, so it's for you, Judith, really, in some ways. So, you know, the bears say that this is like a Ponzi scheme, that you get false signals, that you can throw lots of factors at it. You don't get good factor returns, and you get false signals of GDP growth. We saw that this morning, for example, that it was said that GDP growth is slower. But if you do it on GDP per capita, it's particularly weak. And the flip side of that, which people don't talk about, is Japan actually is outperforming or equal to the US, both pre-GFC, post-GFC, because of its demographics. Growth's actually quite good.
Yeah.
But how the false signals that we're potentially getting in terms of the management of the economy, because in effect this is creating a surge of growth dynamics in housing, in wealth, etc., and what are the implications of that?
Look, I think it's a really important question, and it's sort of the political economy of immigration policy, because if, you know, everyone, you know, the government boasts about the fact that we haven't had a recession for over 25 years. We actually have had two recessions in terms of GDP per capita. And GDP is not really the right figure. We probably should be looking at net national income or something. And again, the results are kind of less impressive than that. But as I understand it, you know, just between these four walls, when the Cabinet discussed the possibility of reducing the migrant intake, and, I mean, you'd hope that they discussed it, frankly, and, I mean, particularly in the context of the housing affordability crisis, that one of the reasons they don't want to do it is that GDP growth, absolute GDP growth, is obviously higher the bigger the economy. That doesn't mean the living standards are increasing, and as you rightly point out, that under any careful measurement of living standards since the GFC, it's been a pretty average performance in this country.
Okay. The question right at the back.
Hazel Moyer, Australian National University. I want to ask about a slightly different aspect about the implications of labour migration in a global economy. Mm. We've been a net importer since the 1950s. Mm. And as a consequence, one category of people that we've imported are the parents of earlier migrants. So there are now 250,000 residents in Australia who receive British pensions, all of which are frozen, which removes $120 million from the Australian economy plus some social security costs. But in looking into that issue, I also discovered the pricing rationing mechanism. And for certain categories of parents who wish to join their children, who we have brought to this country as workers, do you know how long the waiting period is?
30 years.
30 years. And the price, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars to allow a parent to join their family.
$50,000.
And we have criteria. You can't come and join your children if you've got four children and one live here. So we've got some... But how? What research has been done... You see, and this is an issue that comes up with Brexit as well because of the fight between the British and the EU about how do you deal with the retirement benefits for workers who've contributed to your economy all their life, and then the social issues when they retire. What work is being done on that broader issue rather than the very short term of, like, how many people do we need next year and why should those 457s be preferenced instead of spouses who want to join their partners or parents who need to join their children?
Well, it's an interesting issue, and whether it does tie in with Barbara's point that I never had my mother living with me when my children were young, but, you know, that would have been great. So at the moment, or there are three ways that grandparents can get in. The first one is to go on the long list. And
well, it's long, the long list is closed. You can't even get on the list now.
And in that case, you also, it suited the Chinese families because it made, the grandparents would come if it made the family complete. So you couldn't have a lot of siblings elsewhere. You could spend $50,000 and get your grandparents in. And then they've recently introduced a temporary grandparent visa category. And that doesn't have the sort of making the family intact criteria. Now, I would point out, though, that the more grandparents we allow in, the dilution of the benefits on the demography start to unravel, really, don't they?
Mm.
Yeah, so it's an interesting issue. I don't know about that, the frozen pensions of the UK. Does Australia
top that up? The British have a contributory...
No.
The British have a contributory pension system.
You do?
We do. Oh, that'd be right.
Okay.
That'd be right.
Jocelyn Newman tore up the bilateral social security agreement with the British in the about 2000 and walked out of a meeting with her counterpart there because they would not even discuss the matter. Mm. I'm trying to get our government to make it a precondition for a trade treaty with the UK.
Right.
I mean, why should we do a trade treaty when they... Do you know how, if you're 90 years old and you moved to Australia when you were 65 as a pensioner to join your single child, do you know how much the British steal from you every year?
Yeah.
£8,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And we make it, that is money lost to the Australian economy.
Sure.
And likely you're on an Australian pension because you're otherwise living on £6 a week.
Yep.
So it's a big issue. And
well,
it
I think the other thing
issue.
About the, it's anomalous because the UK does have agreements with other countries where they do pay indexed pensions, as
not
I understand.
Commonwealth.
Oh, not former. Okay.
Okay. The gentleman in the middle has
right.
questions. Yeah.
Thank you.
Dud your friends, I say.
Thank you. Jeremy Sammet from the Centre for Independent Studies. One of the unspoken assumptions behind Peter's presentation, I think, is that migrants are going to be happy to come in and work and breed and pay tax to basically prop up the health and welfare system, state-funded health and welfare system for older Australians. But by his own account, and I think particularly going from what Dr. Broadway said, migrants seem to be far more family-focused. They seem to be here for what the benefits of coming to Australia are for themselves and for their families. Is there a chance that ramping up migration could actually increase the sort of intergenerational conflicts we might see over health, welfare and tax spending rather than reduce them?
Yeah, I don't see that. I think migrants are motivated. I don't think they're kind of more necessarily more family-oriented than Australians. You know, birth rates are very much the same for the two groups, and marriage rates, and et cetera. So I don't think there's any great...
I thought you said birth rates were higher for migrants.
They're not. In fact, they're slightly lower, you know, on average. There are some groups that are quite high, but on average, the migrant birth rates are, in fact, lower than the Australian-born population.
Brabo, you want to respond?
Essentially similar. I'm not sure they are more family-oriented than the local population. I mean, I'm sure their families play a large role for what they do, just like they do for anyone. But I'm not aware of any data that really compares the Australian population with the migrant population in terms of family orientation or what the real empirical measure of that would be.
Okay, last two questions. Gentleman there, and then follow by a gentleman in the middle there.
John Daly from Grattan. Judith, I take your points that we often don't think about the collateral impact of migrants and in particular their impact on housing affordability. And you suggested that this might have political implications, but here's one of the kind of oddities of this. If we look at where is the anti-major party vote growing fastest, the answer is very obviously in regional areas. If we look at the political parties that are really running a full-on anti-migration program, it's basically One Nation Party, whose vote in essentially city Brisbane is, in central city Brisbane is almost non-existent, and is only material in kind of outer in more regional Queensland. The precise places where there aren't any migrants and all of the externalities which you talk about, and I understand where you're coming from, don't really impact any of the people living there. So what do you think is going on there?
I'm not sure that's entirely right. I think really the swing electoral areas are the outer suburbs. I know if my friend Angus Taylor was here, who's sort of at the very edge of Sydney, he would say that there's a very big sort of One Nation drift in those outer suburbs, and that's where I think you see a lot of those... the pressures on congestion, urban amenity and the look, it's a real chicken and egg thing. I mean, I'm not absolutely convinced what you say is true in terms of infrastructure always lagging. I mean, if you think about when a lot of infrastructure was not held by the private sector, you think of, for example, energy, the SECV was run by engineers who doubled it and then doubled it again and then doubled it for a final time just to be on the safe side, right? So, in fact, we had quite a lot of spare infrastructure in certain areas, which we've now truly and truly run down. I mean, when you go up to Canberra, they could have, like, probably two or three times as many people up there. You do have a little traffic jam from time to time, but not much.
10 minutes.
But I don't think anyone believes in Melbourne and Sydney there's unused infrastructure and the pressures on congestion, urban amenity and housing affordability are quite extreme. But, of course, in terms of political attitudes, it's kind of often more amorphous than their direct lived experience, isn't it? So they read about this stuff and they might attribute things not going well in their lives to factors that may not be true. Yes, of course, in the inner city areas where a lot of the, international students live, they're increasingly swinging green, not swinging anywhere else.
Peter, you want to add anything?
No.
Okay, our last questions.
Tim Kolbach, Inside Story. We've heard a lot of numbers based on assumptions and suppositions about what might happen in future or might have happened under certain assumptions. I've just got facts from the Australian Bureau of Statistics about the actual behaviour of the actual labour market in the last 8 years, taking 2008 and 2016. In those years, the number of Australian-born workers who were unemployed swelled by 54%. The number of them in full-time jobs grew by only 1%. Peter told us that migration has no impact on the labour market. Fortunately, he didn't provide any evidence of that.
I was quoting Robert Brunig.
I've got the floor, Peter. Number of 15 to 24-year-olds who have left school, college or university, who have a full-time job, shrank by 214,000 or 21%. The number of them in part-time work, however, jumped by 29%, and the number of them unemployed shot up 36%. It wasn't that they weren't going into the labour force. We had lots of people going into the labour force, and these are school, college, university leavers, and they did not get full-time jobs. Who did get them? Three-quarters of all full-time jobs in the last 8 years have gone to recent migrants. 168,000 have gone to Indian-born people, and 74,000 have gone to Australian-born people. Don't try and tell us that migration has no impact on the labour market. That is bunk. Just finally, on the 15 to 24-year-olds... just read those figures. It's OK. But I've just made my point. There is clearly an impact of migrants on the labour market opportunities, not just for the bottom people at the bottom, but also, as Stu has pointed out, for people who are coming out of universities and who career opportunities.
Thank you.
To pretend otherwise is just bunk. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you're making my point that the distributional impact, we've got to look at that. You know, and I mean, I think the PC report does show you that if you're going to go and look anywhere, you might want to look first at the youth labour market, because it does seem that Australian-born youth have done badly, and they've also had a very big increase in their rate of underemployment. So it's their participation's fallen, their wages are not good, and they're increasingly underemployed.
Peter, you want to...
Yes, so well, I was citing Robert Brunig primarily in a chronometric study that he made that said that was the one-liner I gave. It came from his paper, and that was a paper commissioned by the Productivity Commission that migrants had no real impact on the... Australian labour force. Now, if you look at, I was involved in the government's 457 inquiry a couple of years back, and if you read that, Tim, you'll see that we did point to areas of Australian graduates where there were problems, and we recommended that there should be a more careful analysis conducted of labour demand, in particular occupations. Raise the prospect that if there were evident issues, then those occupations should be capped or capped on a regional basis. So I certainly recognise that there are issues, and we pointed to some direct areas where that's the case. What I'm presenting is a bigger picture than that, that in the end... we have a labour force which, without migration, would hardly grow at all. And we have a labour demand which is presently demanding much more labour than the native-born or the Australian population, not native-born, can provide. We're looking in. And I've got the floor, Tim. I've got the floor, Tim.
Let Peter continue. Peter, we can't hear you. Peter, can you?
I think the demand for labour in the future in some areas is very, very large, and the NDIS, and aged care. Providers, huge demand for care workers in the future. We do not have the capacity in Australia to provide the workers for the demand that's in that sector. Okay, so the government now is ramping up the notion of infrastructure and building a lot of infrastructure. Again, we do not have the labour with the skills to satisfy that labour demand. So it's all about segments. I'm not saying that there's not areas.
So I think we okay. We have to come to a close. This is a very controversial issue here. There are lots of issues to talk about. We can go offline and continue the discussions. We should thank our three speakers for excellent and interesting sessions.